Je vous demandais, s'il vous plaît, prendre vos sièges parce que je voudrais commencer les séances cet après-midi. Mesdames et messieurs, c'est un grand plaisir, un plaisir très énorme, vous introduire cet après-midi la rectrice et le vice-chancelier de l'Université McGill, professeur Heather Monroe Bloom. L'autre coprésidente de notre séance des congrès de sécurité de l'alimentation mondiale. Professor Heather Monroe Bloom is the principal and vice chancellor of McGill University and a professor in our Faculty of Medicine. A distinguished psychiatric epidemiologist, sorry Heather, she has dedicated her career to the advancement of higher education, science, and innovation in Canada and internationally, advising governments and other organizations on the role that universities and research play in advancing international competitiveness and enriching societies. I'd like to ask Heather, please, to come forward and say a few words.
Merci beaucoup, Chandra. Bonjour et un peu tard, mais bienvenue à McGill et ici à Montréal pour vous tous. It gives me great pleasure to say a few words, and I'm humbled because I'm sitting in front of experts in food security, food production, and food safety. And I know that you have come from around the world, from different sectors, not-for-profit industry, academic, and government organizations. And you've had an intense couple of days working on issues that I think rightly one could claim are as important as any public policy issues that we may concern ourselves with. You'll permit me a moment of pride in just recognizing Dean Chandra Madramutu and our wonderful colleagues at our McDonald campus in agricultural and environmental sciences. And I take pride as well in the fact that McGill has had a commitment to both making local contribution and operating on the international stage, and to having an interdisciplinary collaboration in our fields of priority, and this is certainly one, where we can bring together people who can span, if you will, the iterative cycle of scientific work and scholarship, policy scholarship, through to public policy, regulatory, and environmental efforts, and then to, frankly, experimentation and new models that might be more productive and serve society better going forward. This is the second annual conference focusing on food security, and it strikes me in reviewing your deliberations over the last couple of days and the thematic elements of the program that as we come to the conclusion of the conference, it makes great sense for us to really say now, what is the action agenda? Who are the leaders going to be who are going to carry forward an agenda? And to say that overwhelmingly, we've not realized the kind of progress in both the production and distribution of safe food, nutrition to the world that one would have hoped would have happened over the past decade, and indeed in a number of domains there's been a decline in effectiveness. This is an issue that affects all of us. If we live in a country as comparatively wealthy and healthy as Canada is, we cannot afford to be concerned only with food security. And for those who live in parts of the world where the production of sufficient food is the overwhelming preoccupation, we know that food safety and food security strike daily at understanding how best to have healthy communities. So I think that we're at a moment where we need to think about not how do we gather everybody into this cause, but how do we form, in effect, a leadership coalition of people from industry, from government, from NGOs, and from universities who have knowledge and experience in this broad field to say we are going to do some things now in the year ahead, not just the years ahead, that will make a real difference, and to formulate You know, we all like wide sweeping policy progress, but maybe we start by having some projects, some pilot projects, where we bring together coalitions of leaders across these dominant sectors of importance in realizing progress, and say, what is it that we're going to do that will mean that when we come together a year from now, we're advancing an action plan, not still looking at the scale of the problem. And so that would be my challenge to you, but I make the challenge to you, saying that this is an area that McGill is deeply committed to, and through the leadership of Dean Chandra Madramutu, but indeed a distributed group of colleagues across the university, that we retain our commitment to really seeing through community service at the local and international level in this important realm. So with that, I'll finish, but I did want to recognize my co-chair, Marilyn Knox, who's been just a sustained force of nature in support of progress in her various roles. As a distinguished senior public servant at the provincial and federal levels in Canada, in her role with a multinational food company, and as someone who in any role she takes on, and we met early on when she was more formally on the full-time public service side, has worked at exactly this issue, waking up in the morning and saying, what are we going to do to make a difference? And then getting people around the table who share a sense of common cause and purpose. And Marilyn, I know how unbelievably pressed your schedule is, how full it is, and I'd ask everyone to join with me in expressing our appreciation to Marilyn Knox for her co-chairing of this event. Merci encore à vous tous. C'est vraiment une joie pour moi et un honneur que McGill ait l'hôte de cette conférence. And as I urge you to press to the next stage and really have a commitment to an action agenda again, let me say McGill will be there with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Heather. Colleagues, our format this afternoon is really going to be driven by you. I thank and congratulate all of you brave souls who are still here at this time after 2.5 days, but it shows your commitment to the subject of global food security. I would like to take a few very brief minutes to recapitulate some of the key messages that I thought that came out of the discussions. I'd like you to take note of them, and you've probably got your other comments as well. We'd like to invite you all to help us to frame where we go next with global food security, with McGill taking leadership on this, with governments, and also with the private sector, the NGOs, and civil society as a whole, in light of the fact that next year the G8 summit will, and the G8 leaders will be meeting here in Canada, and food security is definitely on their agenda, as we noticed in L'Aquila this year, and a further commitment to food security. So it's going to be your afternoon, your participation, and I'm also going to ask a few key individuals who have participated in the conference to also come forward and say a few words to help us, to challenge us in where we go next. Just to remind you that there are 105 million hungry people in the world today. Over 1 billion are malnourished, and it's very appropriate that we are meeting at a time when we will celebrate World Food Day next week. And the theme of World Food Day next week on October 16th is Achieving Food Security in a Time of Crisis. So we've really addressed, I think, in this conference many issues that can make a very clear message that we take forward on World Food Day. Our very distinguished panel that kicked off our public lecture on Monday afternoon, I'm deeply grateful to this very high-level group, and you'll probably see many of your faces here in our public lecture. We had over 375 participants at the conference in all. One of the key points that arose many times is the era of cheap food over. Is there a new way, a new model going forward in terms of food prices, where we'll never see the lower end of food prices as we've ever seen them before, as we've experienced cheap food, with all the problems of food security and with the food safety measures that will need to be put in place, we may see increases in food prices for quite a while to come. Some of the key messages that I've taken away from the conference is that the food crisis will not come to an end very soon. And as a matter of fact, we were reminded of the public lecture by the Assistant Director General of the FAO that the food crisis has been in the making for at least the past 30 years. It is, in fact, a long-term structural problem, and that the financial crisis has exacerbated the current food crisis. There's this call by the G8 and the G20 leaders, as we saw recently in June in L'Aquila, to reinvest and to inject new capital into agricultural development. And the whole question of smallholder productivity was also raised, and how do we put into context this contradiction between low productivity of smallholders versus large-scale commercial enterprises. Secondly, with respect to risk management, we saw some very innovative tools produced, especially by our colleague from Kenya, from the NGO Pride, who presented information on new risk management measures that need very strong institutional support, public-private partnership that needs to come together with civil society and agricultural producers to ensure a steady flow of capital to the agricultural sector. We've heard the call that there'll be a need for $55 billion U.S. dollars a year just to address the gap in food production in developing countries. How do we mobilize that type of financial investment with the international agencies and the aid donors to make this happen? Research and development and capacity building was also another very strong theme that came out of the conference. The need to take research results rapidly from the laboratories, from the fields, through the agricultural extension services to disseminate information to the agricultural producers, who are the backbone of the economy in many parts of the world, and to ensure sustainable agricultural development and food security. How do we work as universities and research centers to help to train the new generation of research scientists that will address some of the problems associated with, in our last session we heard, for example, climate change, drought-resistant crop varieties, salt-tolerant crop varieties, the introduction of biotechnology, for example. One of the key messages I also took away as an agricultural scientist myself was this large gap in crop yields that we have seen. And Doug Headley alluded to the fact that we're witnessing a decline in crop yields right now globally, including our major crops. And we need to pay attention, and that's another reason for the need for rapid dissemination of technology, introduction of existing technologies, as well as some newer technologies, to increase by sevenfold the crop yields, the potential crop yields that have been observed in some places. So this large gap in crop yields certainly is something where there's a lot of potential, particularly as we look at some of the issues around climate change. We've heard a lot about the international agencies who have reacted very quickly, especially through the formation of the UN Secretary General's high-level task force on food security last fall, where all the UN agencies, the World Bank, came together, the regional development banks, to mobilize the resources for short-term food assistance as well as short-term financing of to reinvest and re-energize, reinvigorate the agricultural sector. And these agencies continue to work under the aegis of the UN Secretary General's high-level task force to seek longer-term solutions in the future. And again, I think there's a role for all of us in this room to help support the work of the UN high-level task force. In terms of trade and markets, there was certainly the very clear message that there's no viable substitute for the liberalization of trade in agriculture. We need to work hard at the reduction of trade barriers, remove protectionism and subsidies. We heard very loud and clear as well that if we fail in the Doha round, then we're doomed, very much doomed. And we saw the data today that a failure of Doha will mean an 11% drop in exports from developing countries with respect to agriculture and a decline of $350 billion U.S. dollars in revenue due to a loss of agricultural market and products. We heard quite a bit about biofuels as well, and certainly the experiences today with respect to Brazil, Russia, and China that were presented in this afternoon's session indicated that biofuels, if produced wisely and with the proper planning, judicious selection of feedstock and various bioconversion methods, wise use of land and water resources can be a viable source of additional rural income without compromising food security. The long-term impacts of climate change remain largely unknown, but certainly in terms of climate variability, this will continue to affect crop yields and food security, particularly in the arid and semi-arid and monsoon areas of the world, where some of the poorest of the poor live. We need to develop risk management tools such as weather index-based insurance models, better water agricultural water management systems, irrigation practices, reservoirs and storage, and drought-resistant crops to help to combat the impacts of climate change and crop productivity. And we also heard quite a bit at this year's conference about the linkage between human nutrition and food security. I have to apologize to you. Our School of Dietetics and Human Nutrition, who have been a very strong contributor to our conferences so far, they're all in Bangkok right now. All the staff in our School of Human Nutrition are in Bangkok because of the large International Congress on Human Nutrition, which is currently taking place. But certainly, this is an area where we believe at McDonald we have a very large role to play to close that gap between nutrition, human nutrition, and food security, which we heard loud and clear from you as conference participants. And last but not least, the influence and importance of aquaculture and fisheries in terms of filling some of the nutritional gaps for protein using non-land-based resources and without competing for the land for food crops. Water and food security was also mentioned quite a few times, and there has been some indication from several, including EFAD, who indicated that they would be quite willing to help to support us with some of our work in water and food security, and probably a high-level summit that looks at water and food security next year. So these were some of the main points that I took away from the conference. Before we all break, though, I would like to call on a few individuals, or before I ask for your comments, please, I'd like to ask a few individuals to come forward and say a few words, and Marco Ferroni, the president of Syngenta Foundation. Please, Marco.
Thank you very much. Vice Chancellor, Co-Chair, Dean Madramotu, ladies and gentlemen, I want to make a very brief and action-oriented statement entitled Partnerships and Tweaking. The term tweaking has been coined yesterday by Chandra in a conversation that we had in this room in the afternoon. And of course, what I'm talking about is tweaking markets into existence to deliver services to farmers to enable increased productivity and, with reference to the last panel, adaptation to climate change. I've heard in these last few days profound reflections on values, justice, farmers, the private sector, markets. I've heard a lot less about how to get organized to reach and make available services and technology to the hundreds of millions of small farmers that need to be reached if we truly want to live up to the promises of our ideal of a food secure world. And more pragmatically, if we truly want to live up to the promises embedded in the L'Aquila G8, G20 initiative on world food security and hunger, which by virtue of it being a G8 initiative also makes it an initiative of Canada. How many millions of small farmers need to be reached? The answer is 400. We've heard on the first evening that in Canada we have 236,000 farmers. Well, in the non-OECD world, the developing countries, we got approximately 400 million farmers, that's to the best of our knowledge given existing census data, of up to 2 hectares, which is my somewhat arbitrary but operational definition to distinguish between small farmers and others. Now, Coke and soap reach many of those today, even at least some of the time. Agricultural inputs and services reach many fewer because they're more difficult inherently to market, in part because the corresponding products for full effect need to come attached to knowledge. So how to reach these farms? And here is my hypothesis. You can reach hundreds of thousands of them through projects that are funded by aid, that work through governments, the donors, the NGO community foundations, corporate responsibility-inspired investments by corporations such as the international, multinationally operating crop science industry. But aid is not sustainable in the long run. And therefore, this is my message, to reach millions upon millions, you need markets. Markets for seeds, CP products, fertilizer, mechanical and irrigation equipment, extension services, financial and risk hedging services, and so on and so forth. And these markets, by and large, do not exist. They must be tweaked into existence through partnerships and hopefully made sustainable through income gains and gradual improvements in purchasing power on the farms, on the part of the farmers, as a result of growing productivity, as well as other plausibly to be expected forces, including out-migration. Now, I do not have time to explain and qualify this model, but it does seem to me that markets are the only method we have to massively scale up. For markets to be tweaked into existence, we need partnerships. And we have heard examples of such partnerships during these 2 days, partnerships that precisely have that purpose of tweaking markets into existence. And so I ask, might this perhaps be a topic for next year's conference? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Marco. I'd like to call on Joe Dibre from the OECD in Paris.
Thank you, Chandra. McGill University, and Chandra in particular, displayed an enormous capacity for foresight in hosting the first of these events last year, an achievement that's surpassed only by their foresight in hosting the second one this year. I can't imagine that they could have known at the time they were anticipating these events just how timely they would be. And I think that, for me, is one of the sources of hope that I take away from this. I think you should be encouraged to continue the effort, and I would hope that we begin to reap some of the messages for this well before next year's event, and particularly in light of the Canadian presidency of the G8. And I hope that we find mechanisms whereby we can feed some of these messages, some of these very messages that you shared with us, into that process as we go forward. Because I don't know how many of you realize just how important, both symbolically and in real terms, the achievements at L'Aquila are. I followed the process myself. Within a month of that event, the hope was that we would get a commitment on the order of $10 billion. And then as we moved closer, there was hope that maybe we could get 12, but that was somewhat soft. Well, in the end, we got 20, and that's since grown to 22. That's an amazing achievement, given that that was the only thing that the G8 and G20 leaders agreed upon at that conference. So it sets the stage for hope for the future that we can finally seriously tackle this serious problem of food security and poverty. Another source of hope for me out of this event was learning of so many success stories. I mean, it can be done. Brazil, China, Vietnam, a long list of countries have achieved poverty reduction at a pace which would enable countries to achieve the Millennium Development Goals. It is possible. Many of those achievements, interestingly, in fact, the great majority of them, have been accompanied by rapid increases in investments in agricultural research, extension, and education. And that's a second takeaway from me from this conference. We have had demonstrated an impressive array of scientific advances, institutional, innovative, imaginative institutional arrangements, and policy alternatives for tackling the problem. We have find ourselves in a situation better equipped than ever before to address the problem. So, what are the challenges? Well, there's a huge portfolio of possibilities and no complete consensus on how to choose or what to choose from that portfolio of possibilities, except for one, and I come back to it again. The need for additional investments in agricultural research, extension, and education were expressed many times over. I heard no one disagree. And, you know, that's pretty rare for a group of economists and agricultural scientists to reach such an accord on a subject. So I think what we need to do now, the next phase, and that's why I've emphasized we should begin now to start to harvest the messages, is we need to convince policymakers, leaders, and donors. I'll take that message back to the OECD and search for ways to communicate that to our donor countries and other stakeholders. Another challenge is a little closer to home. We're an organization dedicated to promoting international cooperation and trade. This episode of crises has shaken confidence in the world trading system at a moment when we are looking to a future when it's even more important, when trading is even more important. Neil Conklin put his finger on it this morning in saying that global food security cannot be achieved one country at a time if we want global food security for all. We have a challenge for my organization to find better ways to articulate that message, to nuance it, to make it less doctrinaire, but to continue to insist that there is no alternative for the future except through enhanced cooperation. Thank you very much for the opportunity to share those with you.
Thank you.
I'd now like to call on Caroline Pestio. Caroline is a former vice president of IDRC, who was one of our financial sponsors, and we happen to have both served on the CG board at Vicasat at one time. So, Caroline, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Chandra. I'm going to, I think, echo, but more at a Canadian level, what Mr. Juber just said. This morning, I think it was Mr. Conklin who talked about an imperative and leadership. The way I see it is that we have a window of awareness. I'm not sure it's a window of opportunity. I think it's a window of awareness. We've been presented with a pretty somber situation in the future over the last couple of days. But we've also realized that there are a lot of things that are coming together to make people aware. And there are also a lot of positive things happening, and I'm not going to repeat the ones that have just been mentioned, but here at home, CEDA has now got food security as one of its themes, and we've untied Canadian food aid, and the Americans are actually even talking about untying food aid. There's been many things have said about the importance of research, and one of the things that impressed me was what is going on in at least a couple of Nigerian universities. I was very struck by Dr. Iniedu's remarks about how they're making radical changes in the way that research is taking place. We've mentioned credit to smallholders. The graphic that Mr. Delgado put up on the impact of mobile phones technology is really remarkable on how it reduces price volatility. And at ICRISAT, a lot of work has been done on tech exchange on mobile phones, not tech lectures by scientists on how farmers should do things, but exchanges between farmers and people who have tech solutions. Finally, and this is what I actually want to talk a little bit more about, people are talking from different groups. And Mario Reno talked a lot about how NGOs, civil society organizations, governments, farmers, co-ops, scientists, and the private sector are talking who didn't talk before. This is really important, and this is where I come back to Coughlin's notion of leadership. We can do an awful lot of shouting and throwing stones. My example is, Paul Collier throwing stones at Via Campesina and Via Campesina throwing stones at Paul Collier, metaphorical stones, of course. And both sides have something to tell us, but they're not listening to each other. And today, in the last couple of days, I think we've made some progress on understanding things like national self-reliance. Yeah, it's not necessarily all good. It's not necessarily all bad. There are nuances. It means something positive if you get it right. Similarly, of course, access to markets and empowering people to use markets. Similarly, tweaking credit mechanisms and so on. Where I think that we should move forward, and in Canada and perhaps at McGill, although I can't tell McGill what to do, but is to offer another opportunity for serious dialogue between people who have different points of view but have a common interest in food security. And one of the things that I think is important is to get the people interested and concerned about environment interested in international global food security, because there is an enormous interest in environment in Canada. There's somewhat less, I think, of an interest in food security, but I think there's a window of awareness, so I hope we'll use it. Thank you.
Thank you, Caroline. I'd now like to call on the Vice Chancellor of Makurdi Agricultural University in Nigeria, Professor Daniel Uza.
Thank you, Chandra. Vice Chancellor, thank you. I'm going to address two issues, one on smallholder farmers and the other on the large-scale commercial farming. On smallholder farmers, this has formed a center stage during this conference. And we know that smallholder farmers are found mainly in developing countries such as Africa, Asia, and South America. I was surprised to hear that there are smallholder farmers here in Canada. But in these countries, the population of a majority of the people live in rural settings, about 80%. And of this, 90% of the food that is produced in the developing countries, which I've mentioned, come from smallholder farmers. And 70% of these farmers are resource-poor farmers. They have a small farm size of 1 to 2 hectares. They also keep few animals and birds. And I want to emphasize here that what they do mainly is mixed farming. In other words, they keep livestock as well as crop and even fish. So I like to say that maybe in further discussions on food security, we should be looking at it as an integrated approach. But all along we have been talking about crop and crop as if it is only crop that forms food. There is a lot of benefits or beneficial interaction between crops, livestock, and poultry. And I think we should be looking at that more closely. The smallholder farmers are the most vulnerable to food insecurity. They go through a lot of pains in production, and their requirements are inputs such as improved planting seeds and parent stock, fertilizer, agrochemicals. They require tractor services, extension services, improved technology, and they require credit. There is also a need for price intervention, because on production of their crops or livestock, there has to be a guarantee of some price for them so that they sell in order to make money. And if that is not available, they will lose. They also need for rural road infrastructure. These issues have been discussed, but a lot more needs to be done in order to promote farming of smallholder farmers. Production under smallholder farmers is low, and it cannot meet the production or the population growth of the various developing countries. The purchasing power of these people is low. Therefore, many of them are hungry. And in these countries, agriculture is getting more and more unattractive, because they're not making money from agriculture. Therefore, a lot of people seem to be running away from it into other ventures. I'd like to say that support to smallholder farmers must be accelerated through increased investment, which has been mentioned, into training, into research, extension, and also assistance and subsidy on inputs to smallholder farmers has to be introduced. I'd like to say that alongside the smallholder farmers, we have to adopt large-scale commercial farming. In other words, we must maintain the smallholder farmers. They are very, very important. But in order that we can see a more accelerated production, large-scale production has become very important. And in some of our countries, fish, poultry, livestock is a better enterprise to go in large-scale production instead of crops, because they yield more profit, a lot more than crops. But what I'm advocating here is that emphasis has to be laid on value chain, such as preservation, storage, processing, and marketing. But this must be structured through government intervention so that farmers must make profit from business of large-scale farming. If this happens, it can attract unemployed youths who are not engaged in smallholder farming, because they don't want to stay in the rural areas. And if we make it attractive, it will then replace the aging farmers who are now involved in smallholder farming. The youth will now be attracted to replace them. And I'm also advocating that the intervention should include credit as single-digit interest rate. This group of farmers, the large-scale farmers, they do not require subsidy, but they are the kind of people who can try their hands on biotechnology within the biosafety regulations of their own various countries. These large-scale farmers also require access to international markets, provided trade barriers are removed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd now like to ask Mr. Gopalakrishnan, the Secretary General of the International Commission on Irrigation and Drainage, to say a few words.
Distinguished Chair, Co-Chair, Dean Chandra, distinguished colleagues, ladies and gentlemen. I am indeed extremely privileged to be amidst you, thanks to Chandra and McGill. It is one of the marvelous initiatives of McGill that we are assembled here to consider the burning topic of the global food crisis, which got aggravated with the economic downturn. Friends, what I didn't mention, I appeared here as a country representative to talk on India, but in reality, I am holding also the responsibility of the International Commission on Irrigation and Drainage. As you know, this particular commission, it is one of the oldest. We are 60. We got ourselves constituted in 1950, and the network includes 106 countries as of now. And the main goal is to see how to ensure food security, handling land and water in the best possible manner. And I am so proud that as of now, our entire international commission is headed by President Chandra Mudramutu. I am thankful to McGill to provide us such an able personality to head this important mission at this juncture of time. So first and foremost, I assure you that it would be our pleasure to partner, join hands, and see how we could move further. I also would be right to mention that not only Chandra, we have amidst us Ali. Ali Shadi was our past president. And in his time, ICID itself set up a task force to look into this global food security, which came up with a document around 2003. We have a constitutional provision how to go ahead with finalizing our ICID position. It took time, and it is at that point of time also when, I must point out, there was a complacency of adequate food stocks, falling food prices, environmental security, agriculture is the worst guzzler of water, and things of all that that would not encourage investment in agriculture. This is around the turn of this millennium, and we consistently felt somehow this is not right. We kept to the fore the compulsions, the imperatives with the growing population. So the document in 2003 asked for more investment instead of about 17% global food stock, enhancing it to 21% to insure against such vagaries of, and we are facing it. And many others who produced at that time documents about virtual water, things could be well off, and global food trade would take care of everything in the near future, or withdrawing that and modifying the documents, and those earlier documents are often forgotten or not referred to. So the messages that I take away from this conference, quite a few, because it is an extremely well-articulated agenda that was for the conference, and the best of the lot around the globe have been drawn, and it is indeed highly rewarding to hear them, and I gained a lot. And we also try to understand about each other, like country-wise efforts need not necessarily be the best option for food security. That came up in the morning. Well, at the same time, if the global actions is not guaranteeing the countrywide food security, well, the countries, they get regeared to take care of themselves. And it was seen last year when, unfortunately, some countries had to take such measures of export ban and securing their food for their people. Now, there could be pointers, but if they don't do, that political government would fall, and the people cannot be afforded to. So there are a lot of things that we try to understand from each other in this type of conferences. So I congratulate McGill and also Canada. And this is almost, I am very happy, these 2 years we could consider so many things. And now we realize that we have to look into new issues, like we saw that the importance of water, the importance of agricultural water management. Are we sufficiently done for some of these things, especially in places like Africa? These things came to the fore. And also the role of the trade, as well as considering the global village, how to move things and to secure the food. Many of these things are not yet fully addressed. If we see within these 2.5 days, we try to do many things, but we haven't done enough, and I am sure that we would be in a position to look at it and prioritize in the coming McGill events. I once again thank you all for giving me this pleasant opportunity to join you and learn also. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I'd now like to call on Chris Delgado from the World Bank, please.
Well, thank you, Chandra, Vice Chancellor, and distinguished participants. Like Letterman, I sort of have my 10 points here. And it's hard. It looks like I'm the cleanup batter, as we say. But I wanted to give some personal reactions, and this is not a studied policy position of anybody but me, but I don't think it would meet with great disagreement, at least within my own department back home. And the first is that food security in this day and age is fundamentally, from the political point of view, is a national responsibility. It's something that national governments feel intensely about. They don't want the World Bank telling them what to do. They don't want bilateral donors or NGOs from abroad or anybody really other than their own people to be telling them what to do on this. And their own people are telling them what to do, so they have to act. Now, we heard, and it was a very striking, the way I think Doug Headley put it, very, very striking, that basically national solutions won't work in isolation. So the decision makers are national, but the outcomes are global. And that creates an interesting sort of market externality kind of issue. Secondly, we really know that trust is key. I mean, we've been through this before in 1974 when a broad variety of countries and people and groups across the world, trust in markets and agricultural markets sort of went down. And that happened again this time. And there's mistrust, as has been said, between countries, and that has been often fueled by commercial disputes or perceptions of commercial conflict. But trust in markets is a fundamentally different thing. And we need to, it's really in everyone's benefit to rebuild that. Now, to rebuild, how do you go about rebuilding trust? That's a very difficult item. It usually, when there's a failure of that kind, it requires institution building. Now, the third point is we talked about smallholders. And, you know, we said 75% of the world's poor, truly poor, are rural, and most of them are involved in farming. It's really too many people to think of handling purely by safety nets. I'll come back to safety nets differently. I mean, they really have to be part of the solution, and that is fundamental to building the trust. That is fundamental. There's no way around it. Now, the fourth point is that we really are pursuing multi-sectoral objectives. I mean, we want people to have better livelihoods that last. We want better nutritional outcomes. I mean, in food security, that's fundamental, better nutritional outcomes. We want reduced vulnerability. Now, the issue is, how do you get there? And certainly each of those, the livelihoods, the nutrition, the vulnerability, all have entry points. They all have things you can do and need to do. But there's sort of an overarching thing, and I think that was my sense of L'Aquila, is that for the first time in 20 years, there's a recognition there's a sine qua non in all this situation, which is you have to do something about agricultural development. That's the sine qua non. It's true that that's advantageous because it produces more food. It certainly directly impacts livelihoods. And in poor countries that are agriculturally dependent, it indirectly does it because it's one of the few ways of really stimulating growth. It's important to equity, and it's important to reducing greenhouse gases, since about 30% of them come from agriculture, basically. So how do you go about it? We talked about boosting productivity, about market access. We need to get risk down, and since the weather doesn't always cooperate and other things, and we have to worry about environmental services. And that's where I want to come to the safety nets, because we sort of have gotten out of this thing of having major famines around the world. But in fact, it's becoming more frequent, and we think there's more volatility in prices. From the sound listening to the climate change people, there's going to be a lot more volatility in weather. And we don't need to reinvent the wheel every 5 years, or maybe it's every 3 years now. And the safety nets, the nutrition programs, they need to be sustainable. They're too expensive to maintain indefinitely. A school feeding program is not something you can maintain without donor funds unless you find a way to build it into other things. And that's where the way of stimulating local agriculture and having sustainable kinds of safety nets and so forth are all linked, and work needs to be done on them. Seventh point is if we talk about national responsibilities, I mean, donors really have to get their aid on budget. Many donors don't put their aid through national budgets. And we really need, I mean, countries need more. They also need better. To do that, to do results-based monitoring, they really have to be able to know what's happening in their own countries. They have to track it. They have to have ways of assessing impact. That's very complicated. There are very few people that can do that. That's a matter of capacity. I'll come back to that point in a moment. Then the public-private. Marco mentioned public-private, and in fact, the level of resources, the way he put it was exactly right. The level of resources required surpass what even governments can do. I mean, agriculture is fundamentally a private sector activity. Even smallholders are private sector agents, finally. And there's issues of equity investments, debt, and capacity building where the private sector can be terribly helpful, particularly things like input supply, but there are many others. And as markets become, I might add, as they become more high-tech and more complicated, the role of the private sector somewhere in the chain in a public-private partnership becomes larger. Finally, we were talking about what the public sector can do, and that's where people like the World Bank, or at least my part of the World Bank, come in, or CETA, wonderful CETA. You have CETA, my friends, but you think of it as a supertanker that basically you set up a program, and these days the government is the one that really decides the program. It's agreed 3 years in advance, and suddenly you have a crisis. And so you want to steer a little bit this way or that way. Now, the usual aid mechanisms are the right ones, IDA or other kinds of investment regular programs. But you need rapid dispersing grant funding that leverages what governments do with their own money and what donors do. And that's what was going on at L'Aquila and going on in the G20. The fundamentals of that proposal really were to provide a slug of grant funding through a multilateral basis that could do that. Now, I don't think we're going to see $20 billion or anywhere like it. I think it's going to happen. I think one reason it's going to happen is the leadership of countries like Canada and Spain that are saying we're going to hold the others accountable for living up to their pledges. But I guess we'll have to see that. And then I come to my final point, which is one that I think the deans, I'm not sure what the collective noun for deans are, but the kleptocracy of deans. No, seriously. What the deans will like, which is that one thing that is the binding constraint in all this, particularly for people like us, is technical capacity. I assure you, I know because I'm in the business, that if you took $500 million and you dropped them into the World Bank, and you took $500 million and you dropped them into IFAD, and another $500 million you dropped into the African Development Bank, within 10 minutes, the phones at FAO would be running off the hook because somebody would have to go out and actually appraise all these projects. And the technical capacity isn't there. And unfortunately, it's not. It's dwindling at FAO or places like it. Also, there's a tremendous need both in countries and in international organizations to boost technical capacity. The regular programs are not adequate to do it. And that's where I think there needs to be some carefully thought out donor grant funding to maintain the institutional memory in agriculture, the rapid response capacity, and the critical mass to actually crack some serious problems. And the same, of course, is true in the research sphere, as we've heard mentioned, that the absolutely critical research sphere. Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, the floor is now open, and this is your chance to participate. There'll be no rebuttals or criticisms, so please feel free to come forward and add your voices. We want to capture everything you say because this is going to help us with some of our conclusions, and especially as you've heard, we'd like to ensure that this material gets into next year's G8 summit in Ontario. So, and other documentation, as Chris Delgado has mentioned, with other donors. So the floor is open, please.
Yes, thank you, Dean, and not only for this opportunity, but for the conference in general and all the excellent speakers that we've had a chance to listen to from a very wide range of backgrounds.
Sorry, if I could also ask each person to please state their name and organization.
Sorry. Yes, Kent Fashion with the Canadian Permanent Mission in Rome. Mr. Ferroni stole a bit of my points, but in terms of additional areas that we need to focus on or key messages that come out, and that's really that if we are to address poverty, we have to focus far more on how to ensure that the farm gate prices for those smallholders are sufficient to pull them out of poverty and give them the kind of livelihoods that that they deserve and we want them to have. And so we need a lot more people focusing on the question about how to help smallholders to help themselves. If a message I took from this conference, whether it's a key message or not, is free to judge, but that there also needs to be more attention to land tenure. It came up when in the discussion of credit, the importance of land tenure for smallholders to be able to borrow. It also came up in terms of where the investment's going to come from, with that the $55 billion figure that you talked about. Most of it needs to come from the private sector, as Hafez Ghanem of the FAO mentioned, and that if people are to invest and if farmers are to reinvest, they need a security of investment, and that that means land tenure. It also came up in the discussion of land grabbing. And then, if I may just correct the numbers at the beginning of your presentation. The 105 million is the number of new hungry as a result of the crises, the food and fuel crisis followed by the financial economic crisis. The 1 billion is 1 billion hungry, not malnourished. It's the 1 billion that are not getting enough calories each and every day. These are the FAO statistics. If you talk about malnourishment, as the speaker from the WFP reminded us, the number goes up even further, and that there's an additional billion beyond the billion hungry who may be getting enough calories, but they're not getting enough micronutrients, they're not getting adequate nutrition, and that to the point where it affects their health. And then there's an additional billion who are overnourished, obese. When you start looking at hunger and malnutrition, or the nutrition question comprehensively, you realize we're approaching half of the world's population. At that point, it should be a lot easier to get the attention of decision makers. And so I would just encourage us to tell the numbers as they are, and hopefully that will help us to ensure that the kind of political attention we see right now in L'Aquila to this issue is maintained, and that we start to answer all the great questions that were raised in this conference.
Thank you very much. Sir, please.
Yes, My name is Kevin O'Donnell. I'm with the U.S. National Committee for World Food Day. And I'd like to congratulate all the people involved both in planning and in giving this conference for the great work that was done. I'm actually on my third ballpoint pen. I've been taking so many notes in the last couple of days. I have one comment that's not a criticism, but maybe a suggestion for next year. I'm kind of surprised that there wasn't a theme or not much references were given to the whole question of aid as such. I mean, Dr. Ferroni and Dr. Delgado mentioned both in their closing statements, and it has been mentioned. But the whole question of aid allocation. We know that a few years ago, a Nigerian or someone from Kenya wrote a famous article that was entitled "Don't Send Aid." Another African academic, I think she's working in Cambridge, has written a book recently. So there's a number of issues that pertain to this, I think, important topic. How do we target aid? What kind of aid? And so on. So that might be a suggestion for next year, that we pay perhaps a little more attention to the actual mechanics of aid and how it could be more efficiently given. Thank you.
Thank you. Doug, please.
Chandra, it may be the wrong level in terms of what I might suggest, but I am reminded of the history of at least the last 200 years where diplomacy has essentially set in place agreements among nations to protect each other, typically from war. I wonder if we can extend that concept of diplomacy to overcome the mistrust among nations, the mistrust in moving forward with two of the most critical agreements that we can do in our lifetime. One is a strong Doha commitment, and the second is a climate change agreement where we are going to limit the negative effects for a long time into the future of the climate change that we have. Is this a foundation of an agreement that we could use to establish trust in moving forward on the two agreements? And if that's true, then what are the kind of protections that nations need, or what would be the chapeau of such agreements? And it seems to me that there would need to be a social contract. That social contract would be about preventing the kind of scenario that the High Commissioner from Nigeria imagined if Nigeria does not develop, and that was 150 million Nigerians walking across Africa for food. It could involve supply commitments. It could involve supply safety nets. It could involve technology sharing in a very open way. And it could involve capacity development across the world and internationalize the concept of education and training all the way from the small farmer through to the research scientists that we so badly need. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. Please, sir.
So my name is Lazar. I work for Equita here in Montreal. I have to say I'm kind of disappointed in the way, in the direction that discussions or the topics here have gone. We've mostly been talking about production and increasing production. A couple of words here and there about nutrition and a couple of words here and there about justice, is what I believe there were two mentions perhaps, but I had the opportunity to participate at the European Social Forum last year, and I went to a section that was dedicated to the food issue, and the kinds of discussion that was going on there was completely different. We're not on a different page, we're in different books, maybe in even different libraries for that matter. And the questions there were more about fairness and allocation and distribution. And this, the gentleman who asked the first question here brought that up. A good portion of the world is starved, and also a sizable portion is stuffed, to paraphrase the title of a book that came out a few years ago. The fact is, since the Green Revolution, we've been in a constant state of overproduction. The question is, who is that production going to? And I mean, if we keep talking about increasing production, and I mean, that's not going to help if that production ends up fueling a diabetes crisis in Montreal. I mean, that doesn't really help food security at all. So, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is that next year, maybe I'd encourage you to invite more of the people who would be speaking at the social forums, because I think you could learn, the people here could learn a lot from them, and the people there could learn a lot from the people here too, because the kind of discussion that we've had here is also absent at the social forums. That said, the Quebec Social Forum is happening this weekend, so if you're still in Montreal, look it up and encourage you to drop in, and there's a couple of workshops on food issues. So, I mean, it could be a great learning experience for us all. I mean, otherwise we end up in an echoing chamber for the productivist and free trade agenda, which is what we've got here. So, thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Please.
Hi. My name is Santiago Alba. I'm from ACF, Action Against Hunger, Canada. I have some comments. Thank you first for the conference and for coming back with food security and nutrition to the agenda. I miss a little bit about the politics of hunger. This is the conference. Hunger doesn't happen. Has been used by politics, by power as a weapon. I think we have to discuss more about why hunger is used, food security is, and food is used by governments and not governments to control and people, so we can put that in the agenda. Land reform and land tenure for sure. Nutrition has been already talked. Action 8 is not the solution. We know that. We have done a lot of mistakes in the past and committing and compromising the future of the communities that we intervene so many times with food interventions. But on the other hand, we have been talking the whole afternoon about what is going to happen in the next 20, 40 years. During the time that we have been here, what, 20, 40,000 people have died from hunger, from food insecurity. So we have to find a solution for these 40,000 people that we have lost in the last 2.5 days, because we have not given them the solution. My last comment is that the power of partnership. Partnership means research institutions, NGOs, governments, local NGOs. We have to work together. We have to put together our efforts. We are replicating so many times the same things because we don't talk enough. I miss a little bit more for the third sector in the panelists, talking more about the implementation of all the research that we are doing at the same time. I'm working in the research department, and we try to do this link, and it's not always easy to work with universities. That's quite difficult to work with us NGOs. And for next year, what I try to ask to all of us is that we can have in the first slide of the next year the number in no 1 billion but 840, so that we are closer to the Millennium Development Goal. If we are not in that number next year, we have not done our duty. So I put that in our goals, try to reduce at least the next year, let's say 60 million people from suffering from hunger. Thank you.
Thank you. Jim, please.
Three things. I think there's...
Please introduce yourself.
Sorry. Jim Cornelius, Canadian Food Grains Bank. When we're reflecting on the conversations over the last 2.5 days, I mean, I have heard persistently, and certainly this is what I hear because this is what I believe, so oftentimes you hear what you believe, but a particular focus on the livelihoods of smallholders is critical. If we're just looking at agriculture as agriculture, I think we'll miss the point of food security, that we really do have to be looking at the livelihoods of smallholders as the outcome that is really central. But the good news is that if we do take seriously the livelihoods of smallholders, they can produce significant amounts of food to meet the food demands of this world. There's often a conversation here, we're hearing of low yields, unproductive smallholders. Well, many times when you actually look at total food production off a small piece of land, maybe the yields on wheat is small, but by the time you had the livestock and all the other crops coming off that land, the total amount coming off the land is actually quite substantial and could be increased substantially. So the potential of smallholders to feed the world is very real. So that can address that problem of increased production. And then the third good news piece is if we actually develop sustainable practices working with smallholders, that the potential of smallholders to both adapt to climate change but also to contribute to the mitigation efforts in terms of carbon capture. There is a potential here for win-win-win on a lot of this. We can get livelihoods up, we can get increased food production, and we can actually have a substantial contribution to the mitigation of the climate change issues here. So I see these things as connected and integrated.
Thank you very much. Sir, please.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Satya from Bioresource Engineering at McGill. The point that I want to make here is we have been seeing, looking at and discussing about how to increase productivity and other things, but there is another point which I feel is kind of missing here. We could save a lot of wastage, on the other hand, by processing. And last year, I attended the same conference, and there was a good emphasis in this area, but this year, I don't see that happening. And especially looking at smallholders, small farmers, simplifying, we have very high sophisticated technology for food processing and all that, but it's not very much applicable for small farmers at the farm level. So simplifying that and applying that, there's a lot of work being done in that area, but looking at the policy side, for example, I see a poster right here about onions. Like 6% of that is being wasted. We can actually make a very good value-added product out of it, provided the policymakers allow us to do that, changing the standards that these can be used. So that's the point which I would like to make here, that changing the policies and the standards so that we reduce and avoid wastage as much as we can, that will ensure food security better.
Thank you very much. S'il vous plaît, Jean.
Merci, Chandra. Thanks, Chandra. Jean Lebel, IDRC, Centre de Recherche pour Développement International. A few remarks, and first of all, the thanks to you and your team and the university for convening that global food security conference, and I like the global because it has been truly global. I think McGill has to be congratulated and you for having Megan and for having voices not only from Canada or Europe or the U.S., but also have many participants from developing region of the world, and I think that's quite important when we talk of food security. I think that the Southern voice being heard in these type of meeting is quite important, not only for IDRC, but I think for the world in general, because there's a lot of activities, whether it's from research, from development point of view, that are taking place there. I take home three, I think, key underlying message that have been brought under the various presentation throughout these 3 days, an excellent presentation in many cases. I think that the first one is to, I think, piggyback on some earlier comment that was made. There's always a risk in front of complex issue to go with very simple, silver bullet-oriented solution. And I think that whether, you know, we're looking at the science and technology, increased productivity or whatsoever, the message I'm keeping here is that this needs to be equitable and access to everyone. You know, there's an equity factor over here, and whether it's the poorest, whether it's women, whether it's children, you know, this needs to apply to all. That would be my first message. Second message I get is there, it's not only about the productivity, it's about the global picture. It's about having this embedded in social context, whether it's through trade, whether it's through mechanism for access, whether it's through land reform and the old shebang, we don't have to rename it. Many speakers have brought this. And third one, I think it has to be done also with a sustainable perspective, whether it's from the environment or the human development point of view. And I think that will be key and more important, whether it's the South or in the developed world in the coming years. So that would be the three messages I would be bringing home. Lastly, I think that I want to acknowledge also that it has been extremely pleasant and refreshing to have views from student and actor from civil society during the conference. I think that I had numbers of conversation on the side with students of your university, other university. It's quite stimulating, and it's quite encouraging for an organization like IDRC to see that there is
community out there that is pushing the envelope, that is asking the right question, and is also looking forward in participating in the global research world for betterment. And a plea to ensure that we have some gender more balanced next year. You've heard this on and on throughout the conference. I'm sure you're going to look into this in the coming year, and if not, you're going to hear it again if there's another conference. And finally, my last point on the youth, I think it would be important also to go beyond the usual poster on the wall to get the voice for the youth in the conference, whether the podium or through particular event. I think they have a lot to say. I've been going through the poster throughout the conference. There's interesting things that are innovative and needs, I think, a higher profile than what we had. So thank you very much.
Merci, Jean. J'apprécie vos commentaires. Madame, s'il vous plaît.
I'm Jenna Senecal from Bioresource Engineering undergrad and part of Engineers Without Borders. One of my professors keeps on iterating in class that we can fly to the moon and back, but we still haven't figured out how to grow corn without soil. And in another class, I'm learning that we're losing 6 to 40 tons of soil per hectare per year. So where's the sustainability in increasing our yields every year when we're not even thinking about if in 100 years if some of this land is going to be able to produce that amount of food? So I thought that was definitely missing in the conference, whether we'll still be able to produce, even here in Canada, enough food to feed ourselves. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll take the last two comments here. Nancy, please.
My name is Nancy Saunders, and I'm here representing Dietitians of Canada on the Nutrition and Food Security Network, which I'm part of the steering committee. I'd written some notes, and I wasn't sure whether I would be asking it as a question, or it seems now I'm going to be saying it more as a comment. I attended the International Dietetic Conference in Chicago. I attended the International Conference of Dietetics in Japan. And at both those conferences, obesity was the issue. And I find that interesting because they were stating that obesity is the new starvation of the world because of the cheap food that we are providing people to cover up the hunger. So I came to this conference because I went to see the movie Food Inc., the movie. I wanted to, when I looked at the titles of all the speakers, it was the same subject matter that was covered in this movie. I wanted to see what the facts were. I wanted to see what was fiction. I wanted to learn more. I did learn a lot, and I'm very thankful for it. And one thing I was interested in hearing it, and I heard it 3 times, and one was on the first day from one of the African countries. It was about breakfast program that they ran in their school and how the added benefit was that they had kids coming to school because they were able to get free food. I'm coordinator of a breakfast program in the school in which I work, and I'm wondering, is that not a way that World Bank's, all these funding organizations can do a guaranteed investment certificate on breakfast programs so that these programs, they run at the community level. They're not instigated provincially. They're nonprofit organizations. But can we make sure that those people that are providing the food to these schools are going to always have access to something to give to the school? Because when that crisis hit, I started hearing rumors that maybe they would be cutting back on the food. And it's like, wow, that's what I don't want to hear. That's what the kids don't need to hear. That's what the parents don't need to hear. So give us a guarantee at that level. And what I also learned at the conference is it's so much involved with the market. So being in the market myself, I know what it's like to have the market drop, but I also know that if I have guaranteed investment certificates, it's guaranteed. So let's do that guarantee for the women and the children that are going to be the future generation.
Thank you very much. Last person, please, sir.
Thank you. Adrian from School of International Development and Globalization, University of Ottawa. I found it very, very interesting, this 2.5 days conference. Notably, I've been very impressed by the discourse and the different points of view. If I was probably Foucault, I would have written a book about this importance of discourse, of knowledge, and how it can make a difference. I agree with what has been said in this last row of interventions from the side of the audience, and I would like to stress the importance we have focused on what is to be done in developing countries to address food security, but I guess that many things can be done also in Western countries. Top-down approaches, that has been probably the main focus on this conference, World Bank, OECD, FAO, powerful institution without doubt, Syngenta. Probably if we were to make a difference and really try to address real problems, the other side should be present here. I totally agree with this observation over there. There is a World Social Forum, Social Forum these days. But why not bring them here next year, like Via Campesina? And for sure, it will enrich both perspectives, and we could learn from each other. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. La dernière intervention par Jean-Marcel Laferrière.
D'un autre côté, la plupart aussi souhaitent améliorer la condition des petits producteurs. D'un autre côté, ce matin, nous avons eu, je pense que c'est le seul représentant des petits producteurs. Ce représentant des petits producteurs s'est montré opposé à la signature de Doha telle que c'est présentée actuellement. Je pense que le président de l'UPA est certainement pour le commerce. On sait que le Canada est un pays exportateur, puis c'est fondamental pour nous. Mais d'un autre côté, si le commerce ne fonctionne pas, si le commerce va à l'encontre des producteurs, de la plupart des producteurs, je pense qu'il est préférable que ce ne soit pas signé. C'est un peu la raison pour laquelle, actuellement, le président de l'UPA s'oppose à la signature de Doha. Il n'est pas opposé au commerce. La plupart des gens souhaitent, puis je pense que tout le monde souhaite, tout le monde a besoin de faire des échanges. Ça m'amène à mon deuxième point. Je pense que la crise alimentaire a été causée par les subventions importantes qui sont versées par les gros producteurs. Ces subventions-là ont amené un effondrement du prix des produits agricoles au point où les coûts de production dans la plupart des pays, même dans les pays qui bénéficient des subventions, les coûts de production sont supérieurs aux coûts de vente, aux coûts internationaux des produits. Je pense qu'il est important de résoudre cette question-là des subventions. Je pourrais proposer, je pense que vous nous demandez de faire des propositions, c'est que si les pays riches, les représentants des pays riches, sont conscients des risques de la pauvreté sur la sécurité mondiale, ils devraient permettre aux dirigeants des pays en développement de protéger leurs producteurs agricoles, de protéger leur agriculture jusqu'au moment où eux-mêmes élimineront les subventions. Si les dirigeants des pays riches n'acceptent pas d'éliminer leurs subventions, comment peuvent-ils demander aux pays pauvres d'éliminer tous les programmes de support aux producteurs? Mon troisième point, vous avez indiqué dans votre présentation qu'on considérait qu'il fallait 55 milliards pour aider à résoudre le problème. Je pense qu'une des façons, ce serait de faire fonctionner le marché du carbone. Je pense que les pays qui sont les grands émetteurs de gaz à effet de serre devraient pouvoir aider les producteurs des pays en développement à faire reverdir leur pays. Je pense qu'il y en a un des intervenants qui a montré les succès qui avaient été obtenus par la plantation d'arbres, la reforestation. Je suis convaincu que si on finançait, on arrivait avec un gros programme de vrai financement, c'est-à-dire de reboisement et d'introduction de l'agroforesterie et des autres techniques qui favorisent la production végétale, je pense que ça contribuerait beaucoup à la solution du problème. Merci.
Merci beaucoup, Jean-Marcel, et encore j'apprécie toutes tes remarques, comme d'habitude. Ladies and gentlemen, we've heard you, we have recorded your points of view, and we will incorporate these into our recommendations and strategies as we move forward, as best as we can in terms of implementation as we go forward. As Doug Headley mentioned, some of these may require very high-level diplomacy, which are beyond our control, but nonetheless, we will articulate them in a way to go forward as we put this through the Department of Foreign Affairs advisors who are working on the G8 summit and other such agencies. Alors, mesdames et messieurs, c'est un grand plaisir encore pour inviter notre haute coprésidente, Madame Marilyn Knox, qui a resté parmi nous pour deux jours et demi pour la fortitude. Merci, Marilyn, et the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. So I walked into this room 2.5 days ago, and it seemed like a large room. And then Mr. Adam from Uganda asked us the question, how often will we eat today? And then we started thinking, would we have our next meal? What would be the quality of that meal? Did we eat too much? Would we get enough? Would we get time off from this to walk it off? And you start blending in your own experience and talking to more people, and all of a sudden the room has become much smaller. And it's a metaphor for what needs to happen on a much broader scale. So I just want to say three comments on people, on complexity, and on action. So when we think about the number of people that are hungry and poor and the 40,000 that died while we've been sitting here talking, are we doing enough? Those people must be in front of our faces. And we talk about the pregnant women and the children 2 and under who maybe don't make it any farther than that or lose life chances because there isn't enough for them. Or are we not thinking enough about them? And so healthy public policy, if we had more of those people in the room, would tell us that we actually can make a significant difference through healthy prenatal care for those babies. We can make a big difference in a generation very quickly, but it requires effort, focused effort. And as we've talked about, as we peeled the onion away from agriculture, you can't talk about agriculture without talking about food. And you can't talk about food without talking about nutrition. And you think about people in dire straits, and then you think about people trying to earn an honest living, and it goes on and on. And so what we've learned is, of course, what we've already known, food being available, food being accessible, food actually being eaten, and then somebody even said, remember to enjoy it. Robert Patterson's pictures of those people who were farming and what that meant to be able to produce it and the joy of being able to give your child something that's good and makes a difference. And then other people, we talked about farmers who are happy and have made progress, and farmers who are dissatisfied and tired of working 24/7. And so then we look at the hope that comes from people, and with not to leave anybody out, but when you think about Nigeria and you think about Brazil and you start thinking about the stories that we were hearing about, it does give us hope, and it actually inspires us to believe that we can make a difference. So people, the people in this room, have really come together, and I think we really can make a difference. The second is the complexity. Oh, my goodness. Can any one of us really actually make a difference? Yes, I think we can. But we talked with Lazar, who's just left, I guess. where did he go? It's so interesting because he has thought more deeply about the things he cares about than I ever did when I was his age. Oh, there he is. He's back. So it's very important to take the energy because you can actually have a debate with him where he's not attacking you. He actually cares deeply. And then Doug Headley, look at the experience of this man who's so incisive. And you have to stay working on this no matter what. So the complexity is important for us. Only will we together be able to unravel this. And I think if you look at the groups here, so we have agriculture people, we have university people, we have people from NGOs. There's not many of us from my sector in the food industry. In fact, this isn't the circle I'm normally in, and I've been honored to be with you, and I've learned so much. And there are government people at a certain level, and we wish that all of their bosses could hear the kind of thoughtful discussion that we've had. So the complexity is understood by people who have dedicated their lives to this sort of topic and by people that are shaping their young careers by it and people that actually walk in big circles that can make a difference. And so that leads us to action. So what will I do when I leave here? What will each of you do, and what will we do collectively? That's a question only we can answer for ourselves. So I'm absolutely going back and finding out what we're doing with land and water use in developing countries, what we're doing with skill transfer. I'm going to think about and ask questions about the D part of R&D in the developing world. I can do that. And people will answer my questions. Is that enough? No. But we start the advocacy route. And what I think has happened here, advocacy isn't just putting across your point of view, but rather having a strong enough point of view that you will actually listen to another point of view and more point of views and actually come to a conclusion. So this has been a unique conference for me. I think the time that each of you have invested in it is important. I honor McGill for having pulled this together a second time. I think we've had good advice on where it can go in the future. So each of us needs to think about what we do. And then finally, there's some thanks. I think it was eloquently put about the students. It's amazing. There have been students working hard on this, the posters that were there, the food that was served. So I think we need to think about, and just hold on for a second, all the students that have been involved, all the faculty, the moderators, the presenters, all the active participants, the people that have traveled so far from their homes to actually care enough to deliver important messages. And finally, the leader of the group, Dr. Chandra Madramutu, who I think really is a unique person that could bring this kind of group together. And if we can bring this group together, we can broaden the circle and really make a difference. So thank you. Safe trip home. Bienvenue. Merci beaucoup.
Thank you very much, Marilyn. I would be very remiss if I didn't close the conference by saying a few very special thank yous to some very special people. As you can well imagine, it took a large group of people, a small group of people, who helped to put this on. And I'm really very, very grateful, first of all, to Cindy Westcott. Cindy, can you stand, please, at the back of the room? Please stand. Cindy was the person who communicated with each and every one of you, sent out all the email messages, booked all the facilities, made sure everything worked to fine-tuned everything to make sure that it was just a precision timing, and did a tremendous job. I also want to thank the organizing committee, my colleagues in the Faculty of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences, who helped me to put the program on. I particularly want to thank Professor Don Smith, who is here. Don helped us to organize two sessions, the one on climate change and biofuels. Thank you, Don. And I also want to thank all the student volunteers, and Caroline Begg. Caroline, please stand as well. you've all had a chance to meet Caroline. She was the person, as you remember, who ran across the room and made sure that everything worked. And she had an army of volunteers from across McGill, not just from our faculty at McDonald, but also from the McGill School of the Environment that she brought together, and some who are here who helped in numerous ways. So thanks, Caroline, and thanks to all of our student volunteers. And again, I'd like to thank our financial sponsors who helped to support the conference, whose names appear on the poster board. We deliberately have not printed out evaluation forms for you. As you have seen, we've tried to keep the paper to zero and have everything on the website. Two announcements about that. First of all, if you do wish to send in comments about the conference, how we could improve things for next year, other suggestions you have, please look at the website. The email address, globalfoodsecurity@mcgill.ca, is on the website. Please send your comments in. We would appreciate that. And we will be putting all of the presentations of the conference on the conference website, both the live presentations and the PowerPoints, and all the follow-up material will be on the website, as we did for last year's conference as well. So once again, thank you all for your participation, all the speakers as well, those who helped to co-chair the sessions. Thanks to Heather and Marilyn, and bon voyage, merci beaucoup encore.